On October 24, 1910, a man named Edgar Watson was shot and killed by a group of his neighbors on Florida's southwest coast. He'd been a leading pioneer in the Everglades, a successful businessman, and almost certainly a murderer. In fact, much about the life and death of Watson is the stuff of myth and legend. It's also now the stuff of award-winning literature in Shadow Country, a new rendering of the Watson legend, which recently won the National Book Award for Fiction. The author is Peter Matheson, whose long and distinguished career includes numerous novels and nonfiction that often explore vanishing cultures and far-flung landscapes. Welcome and congratulations to you.
Good evening, thanks.
What drew you to this character? I read that you first heard of him as a young boy yourself.
Well, I was probably about 17. I was traveling up the southwest coast of Florida with my dad, and he loved fishing. He had a boat, and he showed me on the marine chart Chatham River coming down from the Everglades on the southwest coast there. And he said, up that river, there's a house. It's the only house in the Everglades. And the man who owned it, I think his name was Watson, he was killed by his neighbors.
And that stayed with you?
That stayed with me. He didn't know much else about it, and I unfortunately didn't get around to writing about it for about 50 years.
But what's interesting to me is, as you write in the author's note, and as we've just said, the plot is essentially, we know the end of the story. Right?
Yeah.
He's killed. So the question becomes why?
That's what interested me. The fact that he was killed is not particularly interesting. How did it happen? Fishermen and farmers and plume bird hunters and people, why would they kill a neighbor? That's what struck me. And then the more I looked into it, I discovered that he'd not only been killed, but very violently by his neighbors, 33 bullets worth. So they meant business, and yet they liked him. And his wives liked him, his children liked him. He was apparently a fascinating person. He was a great storyteller.
He clearly fascinated you.
Well, of course, he grew in my own mind, too, and I gave him, to make it easier, I think I gave him a pretty good sense of humor of a kind of a dark kind. But nonetheless, because he was, how did this happen? Why is a man like this killed who was so able and so charismatic? You know,
one of the other characters even refers to him as our kind of hero. So he had a heroic stature as well as
in a
sense dark side.
He did, even though they were very, very frightened of him. Mm-hmm. Actually, he wasn't in the book at all originally. The book was mainly about Florida environment, the Everglades, the destruction of the Everglades, the Indian people who were there, who were the last untamed Indians, in a way, almost in America. That interior of Florida was very wild. It was a great cattle state, which we forget now, you know, Tampa, Miami. But the interior has always been very mysterious and still is a very powerful place.
Well, you know, that's what I want to ask you, because Watson is this extremely vivid character in the book, clearly. But the other vivid character among many is just the place, Everglades.
Yeah.
Wild, the smells, the storms, the difficulties of living there, the sea. And you wanted to capture that sense of place?
I've been a naturalist, an environmentalist, really, since I was a kid. I mean, I was fascinated by that landscape. It was so untamed and everything. And also by the Indian people there. I worked with them. I did articles on them. And somehow I wanted to tie that all in together. But the place, as you say, was a very powerful presence in the book and the whole way I saw it. Watson was simply meant to be a kind of a vine to tie it all together, but he enveloped it finally. He became so huge, in the picture that it really, he took it over.
Now, another fascinating aspect to this this book is actually that it was originally three books written in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and you came back and reworked it, which sounds like an unusual endeavor.
It was.
Why?
I was advised strongly against doing it, because the three books, Killing Mr. Watson was the first, and that was the name of the original book, which was about 1,500 or more pages. It was an enormous book, and the publisher naturally balked at that, and so we split it up into three. And the middle part, which was called Lost Van's River, I think had the best material in the trilogy in it, but it was weak by itself. It just didn't work as a split apart. And then the third book, Bone by Bone, was probably the strongest of the three. I just wanted to redo it, put it back together as one book. But in the doing, I rewrote the whole thing.
You rewrote the whole thing?
I took about 400 pages out of it. it's quite a lot, and I rewrote it completely.
And reimagined parts of it?
And reimagined it. The hero of the book actually is a black guy named Henry Short. He's the kind of quiet hero. And I didn't give him a voice in the first version. Henry gets a voice now, and especially in the first part. There are a lot of changes like that I made. And I think it's a very clearly a different work and better.
You know, you were first, and maybe for a long time, best known for your journalism and nonfiction and travel writing. And I read that at the award ceremony for the National Book Award, you said, "I had a hard time persuading people that fiction is my natural thing, not nonfiction." I was quite surprised and taken by that. This was something you had to overcome?
Well, I did. I wrote, in particular, a book called The Snow Leopard, which won the National Book Award in the nonfiction category. And The Snow Leopard kind of tended to push my fiction aside. And I had a novel that was nominated years ago at Play in the Fields of the Lord. That was nominated, but it wasn't the winner. And somehow I just wanted to set that aright. I just felt fiction really is what I want to do and I always wanted to do. But I am a journalist, too. I write about the environment. I write about social problems. I work with Cesar Chavez. I worked a lot with American Indian people. And that fascinates me, and I want to do that. But my heart is really in the fiction.
And so how do you balance it? Because here you've taken a real story of Edgar Watson. You could have written, I suppose, a nonfiction biography. What does fiction let you do?
Fiction allows you, to me, it allows you to go deeper just simply because you can imagine it. Nonfiction, you're stuck with the facts. I mean, some nonfiction people are not stuck with the facts, but they should be, I feel. And investigative journalism is really quite a different thing. Fiction just, you can go with it. Actually, you see, Watson, there's very little that was really known about him. I got all my hard facts from gravestones and county records, because the rest was all myth and legend and everything. And his family wouldn't talk about him at all. Later they came to me. As the books went on, they began to see that I was making this guy a human being. And they came to find out. I was able to show some of the family the first photograph of him they'd ever seen.
Really?
Which I found in North Florida in a household up there of a cousin's.
So in a sense you did bring him back to life.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
All right, the National Book Award-winning novel is Shadow Country. Peter Matheson, nice to talk to you.
Very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
We were talking earlier about the mix of activism and writing and how you pair them. How do you see that, your different roles?
Well, the activism is very important to me. I've been an environmentalist really since very early on. And I still work a lot with wildlife. I'm a field guide, a field leader for a safari company out of Austin, Texas.
Oh, really?
And we go all over the world, and which is wonderful for me. And we take people and see. We pick out the animals we want to see, and then people sign up for it. And this friend of mine has a wonderful tour company down there. And so I do a lot of that. I also do a lot of environmental writing. I've been working a lot in the Arctic in recent years, on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and also up on the northwest coast where the Inuit Nupiat people are up there.
What's the story? Is that something you're working on now?
Yeah.
So what's the story?
I'm doing a series of pieces for the New York Review of Books on that. And we're trying to just get attention to the Inuit. Their whole lifestyle, life way is disappearing with global warming. The permafrost is melting, and the villages are being flooded out. And on top of that, the oil companies are doing this very, very destructive blasting, sonic blasting of the sea bottom out there in the Chukchi Sea, which throws off the bowhead whale migrations, it throws off the ice and the polar bear and the seals, everything they need really is for survival. So that's been a big environmental concern, not only for the wildlife, but for the people there and the traditional people. And as you may know, I've worked for many years with American Indian people here and there.
And written
quite a lot about that, too. Mm-hmm. It happens that a man I worked with a lot, Leonard Peltier, he's a rather a famous case.
Which you wrote about extensively.
Extensively, and we got sued for it with the publishers. But he's still in federal prison, and a very controversial case, even though the Justice Department admitted they never proved that he was guilty. Mm-hmm. He's still been in there for 33 years. He's coming up for parole next month, so I'd like to write about that and get some attention to that case, because it's a very painful case and rather a disgrace to our justice system, as his own judges have said over and over again. Why is he still in there? So I'd like to pay attention to that. So I have these projects, the environment and social issues like that.
And you have found a way to somehow make it work putting them together.
It seems to me they're all very, very closely related problems. I think the environment and social issues are very close, because where you have bad social problem, you always have an enormous impact on the environment around. Mm-hmm. And poor people always get shortchanged. And then we have the oil companies especially, but also the whole industrial complex have been, you know, they've been going for deregulation very, very hard for the last 8 years. And those rules are really all that's holding the fabric together. I think the oil companies have been particularly reprehensible, ExxonMobil in particular, because they're undercutting all the research about global warming. They're trying to say, oh, no, that's nothing, and so forth. And for that extra profit or investment, they've, I think, done a lot of harm.
But these interests,
yeah,
you managed to get in the novels as well.
Yes.
I mean, not in that kind of overt way as the journalism, obviously.
No.
But in telling the story of the Everglades, it's another way of telling us about our environment.
It's the destruction of the land and the wildlife and the environment for our selfish short-term interests. And the world can't afford that anymore. Our society can't afford that anymore. We have to really take very stern steps. And I would implore the industries to also pay attention to this and not see what they can exact from our beautiful country.
All right, Peter Matheson, thanks again.
Thank you very much. Plume hunters shoot early in the breeding season when the egret plumes are coming out real good. When them nestlings get pin-feathered and squawking loud because they are always hungry, them parent birds lose the little sense God give them. They're going to come in and tend their young no matter what. And a man using one of them Flobert rifles that don't snap no louder than a twig can stand there under the trees in a big rookery and pick them birds off fast as he can reload. A broke-up rookery, that ain't a picture you want to think about too much. The pile of carcasses left behind when you strip the plumes and move on to the next place is just pitiful. And it's a piss-poor way to harvest, because there ain't no adults left to feed them young and protect them from the sun and rain, let alone the crows and buzzards that come sailing and flopping in, tear them to pieces. A real big rookery like that one the Frenchman worked up Tampa Bay had 400 or 500 acres of black mangrove, maybe 10 nests to a tree. Might take you 3-4 years to clean it out. But after that, them birds are gone for good. It's the dead silence after all the shooting that comes back today, though I never stuck around to hear it. I kind of remember it when I am dreaming. Them ghosty trees on dead white guano ground, the sun and silence and dry stink, the squawking and flopping of their wings, and varmints hurrying in without no sound, coon, rats, and possums biting and biting, and the ants flowing up all them white trees in their dark ribbons to eat at them raw, scrawny things that's backed up to the edge of the nest, gullets pulsing and mouths wide open for the food and water they ain't never going to come. Luckiest ones will perish before something finds them, because they's so many young that the carrion birds just can't keep up. Damn vultures set hunched up on them dead limbs so stuffed and stupid, they can't hardly fly.